All right, we're running. This is lesson two in our study of the Lord's Day, or the Christian Sabbath. And if you're wondering what this picture is, since I've already gotten questions about it, this is called the Didache. This is the earliest Greek copy of the Didache. Does anyone know what the Didache? Anyone ever heard of the Didache? Anyone ever read the Didache? Okay. If you haven't, you really should. It's actually really an interesting document. It's only about, I think it's like 15, 16 chapters, and they're real short chapters. It's basically an early Christian, kind of like a directory of worship almost. It's just a manual for Christian living. And it was written probably around the same time as the Revelation of John, so it's pretty early. You'll see why I put it up here in a minute. I just thought it would be, for anyone interested, there's a lot of really interesting elements of the document. It actually mentions several New Testament books, mentions things about the two offices of the church, the elders and the deacons. It's got things on baptism. It actually has a section on abortion and murder of unborn children. So it's really it's a fascinating thing. If you haven't read it, it's pretty easy to read. So this is part two, the Lord's Day, and I called it historical theology. It'd be kind of a historical theology, kind of just a history. But I realized last time while I was talking in the introduction that I ran through a lot of things pretty quickly. I think I opened up a whole bunch of can of worms and just let them go. And so people kept asking me afterward about all these questions of different things. And I was like, I'm going to get to it. So that's the hope here, is that in this second part we can start to actually get to some of the issues. One of the ones I got a lot was the change of the day from Saturday to Sunday. And while we're not going to address maybe the theology behind that, we will start to address the issue here, and I think you'll find it interesting at least. So, I started off with some why historic theology, so why start here? And in my thought process, these were some of the things for why I thought maybe this would be important before getting to the Bible and before getting to the systematics. And that may sound weird. Let's get to this before the Bible. So my number one here was, I think it shows us pretty well the development of certain arguments over time. So as we go through the history of it, you'll actually see some of the developments of the arguments for the Lord's Day and also some of the ones against it. That'll make more sense as we go through. It'll also show us that some of these arguments are not new. So you'll actually see in the history, like with the actual people, that some of the arguments that we're going to get to in the Bible and theology were already being discussed, such as the change of the day and its relation to the Old Testament Sabbath. But you'll also see it from scholars who are treating the past and see how their arguments... Anyway, you'll see that they're not new. So it'll be good for us to be familiar with some of the arguments so that when we do get to the Bible, you'll start to understand why I'm making these points and why it's important. Let's see. Okay, number three, it provides or adds context that might sometimes be absent in the scriptures themselves. I realize that might sound kind of strange, but when we get to Revelation 1:10, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with, where it says, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day, you'll actually see why historic theology may be important at this point, since the Bible itself only uses that term, the Lord's Day, one time, and does not add any context to it. So I've heard preachers recently who will speculate about all sorts of different things that this could possibly mean. When in reality, if you look at the history of it, I think it really only means one thing. So we'll see that. Number four, it's useful for discussing the development of thought and the growth of the church and its understanding of certain doctrines. So we'll see that there is a lot of development. So when we're looking at the church fathers and stuff, they may not say things that you would necessarily say. You got to treat the fathers within their context and not try to impose our our theologies retroactively onto them. So, but we will see that the church was wrestling with a lot of different things, and one of them was the Lord's Day and its relation to the Sabbath and how it should be observed. And then number five, we want to know if our doctrines were derived purely from tradition or from solid biblical foundations, even as they developed. So I know it's running off there a little bit, but one of the arguments we'll get to is that the Lord's Day was changed, or the Sabbath was changed from Saturday to Sunday by tradition, and just by government fiat. Constantine just made the decision to change it. The Roman Catholic changed it later on. So we'll see that these things are not true, and that they actually have a pretty solid foundation from the Bible into the early church history. So I hope all that makes sense. I'd like to stop here and just think, does anyone else have any thoughts on why historic theology may be important, especially related to this subject? Or did I cover it just awesomely? All right, thank you, Dave. With that, we'll move on to my outline of historic theology. I've added the first one, actually. Most, I think, seminary classes will typically deal with the last four, the patristic period, the Middle Ages, the Reformation, and the modern era. I've added the intertestamental between the Testaments and the New Testament period, and you'll see why here in a minute. But I'd like to, I think most of our focus will probably be on the patristic period, so the early church, and then the Reformation period, since that typically affects us as Reformed Presbyterian. So those will be kind of the two big ones. We'll touch the Middle Ages with Augustine and Thomas Aquinas, and then we'll just kind of speculate on the modern era and some of the, maybe what's led to sort of the downfall and Sabbath observation and stuff. So, all right, so with no further ado, this is the intertestamental period. So I'm dealing with kind of the second century BC, or about 200 BC to through the New Testament period here. This map here is called the Jewish diaspora, and it's just showing you where the Jews were located. Pretty much, this is first century AD or CE. And what I'd like to just point out with the map, and I was going to use the laser pointer, but it doesn't reflect off the TV very well, is just to familiarize yourself a little bit with Antioch up here in the north, which is where Ignatius was located. It'd be modern-day Turkey now. So Ephesus is in here, Corinth's in here, Jerusalem, we all know where that's at, but Alexandria was is a Hellenistic society, so it was largely influenced by Greek culture. But there were actually, there was a great congregation of Jewish population there as well. So, the two main populations, Alexandria and Jerusalem. And we'll see why that's relevant in a sec. Alright. So, for this period and for the next period, so the intertestamental and the patristic period, I just listed out a few of the objections that you would either see in that time period or by scholars later on. So the number one here is that the Sabbath was not created for or binding on all men, so that it was only created for the Jews. Number two, that early Christians were not Sabbatarians. And by Sabbatarian in this instance, I mean that the day was not treated. The objection is the day was not treated as a whole day, and it wasn't treated as a day of rest by the early church. So that's typically a scholarly objection back onto. And we'll touch that. We'll get on to that. But number three, the change of the... Yes?
When you say that was the scholarly opinion, are you talking about contemporary scholars today?
Right. So, yes. Yeah, well, actually, we're going to look at one guy in particular who's been pretty influential on the issue, stating that it wasn't a whole day. It was typically just, it was just a partial day. It was a time to gather together. Maybe how a lot of modern Christians think of it. It's just a day to gather in the morning to observe the Lord's Supper and then to go back to work or something. So it wasn't a day of rest either. So we'll look at that. Number three, that the change of the Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday was a decree of Constantine, the Roman Catholic Church, or a later invention. You actually see this a lot if you go and you search, like, Sabbath on the internet, and you'll get all sorts of crazy stuff. It'll be, a lot of them, you know, will make that... it's like the idea with the canon. We didn't really have a Bible until Constantine. You know, Constantine's just like... He's like the glue that holds us all together, you know? So, we're gonna look at this one. A lot of Seventh-day Adventists will also say that this is where it came from. It wasn't, it's not in the Bible, it's not part of the early church. Number four, the patriarchs did not observe a Sabbath. It was instituted at Sinai specifically for Israel. Some of these we're gonna get to in the intertestamental here in a sec, and some we'll touch in the patristic period. Okay, so, the intertestamental period. So, there's two strains of Jewish thought at this time, interpretation of the Old Testament. There's the Hellenistic, or Alexandrian, which we looked at, and there's the Semitic, or Palestinian. So the Hellenistic, or the Greeks, they tended to blend together Greek thought and Old Testament law into one. So they tended... And that doesn't mean that it had influence on what I'm about to say here. I just wanted you to know, like, what it means that they're Hellenistic. Interesting, in Acts 6:1, you can actually find mention of the Hellenist in there. So that's what it's talking about here. And we're going to look at Aristobulus and Philo. But so they tended to view the Sabbath as a creation ordinance and common to all men, not just the Jews. And then there's the Semitic or Palestinian, and I gave the Pharisees as an example, located mostly in Jerusalem, but tended to view the Sabbath as a memorial of deliverance, a la, like, Deuteronomy 5, and peculiar to Israel. So in the first, you can kind of see they might put more emphasis on the Genesis account, creation ordinance, and the second, more emphasis on Deuteronomy 5 and it being a deliverance from Egypt. So... Let's see. I threw this back up here in case you couldn't remember where those places were. I don't know why I did that. All right, so this is Aristobulus. And I apologize ahead of time. There are going to be probably quite a few quotes in the history portion here. I promise not to do this through the whole class, but just to kind of give you an idea of the different thoughts here. So Aristobulus, Hellenist Jew, living about 181 to 124 B.C., and this is what he says. So, with this, it is closely connected that God, the creator of the whole world, has also given us the seventh day as a rest, because for all men, life is full of troubles. He has plainly declared that the seventh day is ordained for us by the law to be a sign of that which is our seventh faculty, namely reason, whereby we have knowledge of things human and divine. So I'm going to say a lot of weird things whenever I quote these people. I just want you to understand that that's not me necessarily saying this is a good... I wanted you to see with the second portion here kind of the meshing together of Greek thought and sort of this idea of reason and philosophy. And they're very philosophical in their thinking. But that first portion especially, I think you get the point. So Philo is kind of a student of Aristobulus, lives a little, you know, a little earlier or later, 20 BC to 50 AD, roughly. And he says, but after the whole world had been completed, the Father hallowed the day following, the seventh, praising it and calling it holy. For that day is the festival, not of one city or one country, but of all the earth, a day which alone it is right to call the day of festival for all people. So, again, get the point there, right? And I throw this one up here. This doesn't actually relate to the creation ordinance, but I think as far as that argument that I said at the beginning about the patriarchs not celebrating the Sabbath, which we're going to see that argument come up again. If you'll remember John MacArthur being again, he'll make that argument a lot in his sermons that the patriarchs never kept the Sabbath. So we'll get to that in more depth. But this is kind of his argument for why maybe the patriarchs didn't. He says Moses gave a second instance of his prophetical inspiration. And he's talking about Exodus 16 here. In the oracle which he delivered about the sacred seventh day, for though it had a natural precedence over all other days, not only from the time that the world was created, but even before the origination of the heaven and all the objects perceptible to the outward senses, men still knew it not, perhaps because of destructions and upheavals. Succeeding generations had not been able to receive from former ones any traditions of the arrangement and order which had been established. So basically he's making the argument that it was lost due to slavery in Egypt, floods, you know, a lot of pretty catastrophic events that may have caused it to be lost to their memory and needing to be reestablished in Exodus 16. So, all right, now for Semitic Judaism. This would be the other side now. So this is from the Book of Jubilees, which was discovered with the Dead Sea Scrolls among the Qumran people. So it wasn't actually accepted in the canon of the Jewish church or in of the Jews or the Christians, but was often read and cited a lot in the early church. But so this is the Book of Jubilees, chapter 2, 21 and 31. And thus he created therein a sign in accordance with which they should keep Sabbath, to bless him who has created all things as he has blessed and sanctified unto himself, a peculiar people above all peoples, the Jews, and that they should keep Sabbath together with us. And the creator of all things blessed it, but he did not sanctify all peoples and nations to keep Sabbath thereon, but Israel alone. Them alone he permitted to eat and drink and to keep Sabbath thereon on the earth. So, just trying to support what I said there about Semitic Judaism attributing it, or it was just given to Israel. So it's also from the Babylonian Talmud, which is basically rabbinical writings put, well, rabbinical teachings put into writing after the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. So a lot of it had oral tradition, but then, anyway. So 2nd century, the Israelites were given 10 precepts at Marah, 7 of which had already been accepted by the children of Noah. And to these, there were added at Marah social laws, the Sabbath, and the honoring of one's parents. Which I realize the math does not add up there. So I'm assuming they had another, so I don't know. But okay. Now I wanted to present two more from Palestinian Judaism that I thought were interesting, and maybe you'll see why before I actually get to the... So... The first is 2 Maccabees 5:19, which is apocryphal, and says, "The Lord did not choose the nation for the sake of the holy place, but the holy place for the sake of the nation." And then this Rabbi Simeon, this is from the Mishnah or the Talmud, he says, "The Sabbath is given over to you," talking to Israel, "but you are not given over to the Sabbath." So, Can anyone take a guess? I mean, why I would throw these up as interesting examples of... What does it sound like? Anybody? Yeah. So, a very interesting parallel to Mark 2:27, where Jesus, after healing a man, says, "The Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath." So it seems, it would appear that there is at least a common Jewish idiom of this time. And I think this parallelism shows it pretty starkly. And what's interesting about it is that in the first two instances, you have basically what amounts to, these things were given to Israel, or to the Jews. And then Christ explicitly saying the Sabbath was made for man. So, it would seem at least, and I'm quoting, this is Roger Beckwith, who I've talked about this book in the first class, This is the Day, which is a historic account of the early church and its treatment of the Lord's Day. And I've given him, I'm quoting him at length here, because I think he makes an interesting point. I don't want to focus too hard on it, but I do think it's worth consideration. So he says, "Christ does not say that the Sabbath was given to Israel, but that it was made for man. The word made, genomai, suggesting a connection with the making of the world, and the word man, hoanthropos, suggesting mankind as a whole. What our Lord's choice of words seem to imply, therefore, is that when God made the world, he also made the Sabbath, and that he made it not just for Israel, but for mankind. If so, he endorses the natural interpretation of Genesis 2:3 in the manner of Aristobulus and Philo, and declares the Sabbath, like marriage, to be a creation ordinance of general and permanent validity." I do think the connection here with marriage, since Christ goes on in Matthew 19 to correct the idea of marriage even back to the creation. It was originally not so. He created the man, male and female. So a similar instance here almost of him correcting the original institution of the Sabbath and why it was made for man. So, and then I wanted to read this footnote from him as well. I didn't put this up on a slide, but he says, the primeval origin and general application of the Sabbath is not in context the main point which Christ is concerned to make. But in the light of the difference between Palestinian and Hellenistic teaching, his choice of words is probably deliberate. The contrast between this saying and his saying in Mark 7:14 through 23 on the distinctions of foods, when he made all foods clean, is striking and appears to refute the idea that for Christ the Sabbath was just one more ceremonial regulation on par with all others. So he could have, in this instance, he could have said, the Sabbath is made for Jews, and I am abolishing. You know, I'm not trying to play the game where we put words into Christ's mouth and he should have said it this way, but it is interesting that he doesn't even imply anything of the sort. He says it's made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So, and we're going to get more into Christ's correction of the Pharisees when we get to the Bible. But for now, we're still in history. So with that, is there any questions about that intertestamental period that, or any comments that may be fascinating? I thought it was pretty fascinating. I don't know if... All right. Well, in that case, we'll just go ahead and move on to the patristic periods. So, like I've already kind of said, it's difficult to synthesize the patristic writers on any given subject. So, it's hard to make a coherent whole out of their theology. I just want everyone to be aware. If you haven't read the Fathers, you would see that pretty quickly, that there's things that they say that, like, I think a lot of us would be uncomfortable saying, and they make connections that a lot of us would never even think to make. A lot of allegory in their works, but and that's not too surprising. The Bible isn't written as a systematic theology, right? It was revelation, and then it was left to the church to discover what God was conveying to it. So. My focus here isn't necessarily to try and give you every viewpoint of the Fathers and try to correct everything they said, or but I do want to run through them and maybe focus more on how the church practiced so we can get an idea of how they treated the Lord's Day early on. So there's three things that I was hoping to maybe focus on here. The first was how the Lord's Day was used in the common vernacular and how it kind of developed over time. And then number two, the transition from the Jewish last day Sabbath to the Christian first day Lord's Day. And then third, how the common objections that we've listed are really erroneous on several points and how the day was treated by early Christians. So... that's my hope. Like I said, we're not here to necessarily correct, in this portion to correct every wrong view. I just wanted to set the record straight as far as the history is concerned. So hopefully we can do that here. All right, part two here, the patristic period, and we're dealing with, I would say we're still kind of dealing with the New Testament. I say 100 here, and then I immediately jump to like 50 AD or something. So. It's hard to, separate out the New Testament from early church history here, obviously. So, I've highlighted these in red here because they're at least points that we've kind of touched on a little bit, so far. But the remaining ones, I think we'll still see that the early Christians were not Sabbatarians, that the change was wrought by Constantine or decrees of the church or something, councils. And then I've added one more for this period specifically, and that was that the Sabbath was changed by Gentiles to Sunday. So this is another argument that it wasn't the Jewish churches doing, it was an outside idea kind of brought into the church. So we want to see that actually it originated with the Jewish church in Palestine. So, all right, so the Lord's Day. We've said the word a lot.
so I thought it might be interesting to kind of give a rundown of how the phrase developed. So, alright, so if you are reading through your Bible and you come across this phrase, the first day of the week, I actually think it's pretty easy to read that phrase and just be like, oh, okay, first day of the week. That's, you know, he's just telling us what day it was. I think it's actually easy to miss that this phrase is used several times through the New Testament. So I've listed here, in every instance of the Lord's rising, and throughout the Gospels, you have on the first day of the week, the first day of the week, the first day of the week. And then in Acts 27 here, so now on the first day of the week when the disciples came together to break bread. 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2. A collection of saints, as I've given orders to the churches of Galatia, so you also must do on the first day of the week. So there's this idea of this actually entering into sort of the early church's vernacular. There's no other day. I mean, there's no other day mentioned in the New Testament so far as, maybe someone can correct me there, but I'm fairly certain, aside from the Jewish Sabbath, the only other day mentioned in the New Testament is the first day of the week. So it's reckoning that according to the Jewish calendar, the first day of the week being our Sunday. And what's interesting as well about this passage, why I've underlined, I've given this orders to the churches of Galatia, is that they're also doing the same thing. So why I pointed out in that map, you know, Galatia's over here in the middle of modern day Turkey, and Corinth is over here on an island on the south of Greece, they're separated by water or several countries. You know, so it's not like it's some kind of cultural development or something. There seems to be a common practice among the churches, the early churches, of meeting on the first day of the week. So, that's important. And this is Stott also in this book, so this is a co-authored book. This is the other guy, his name is Wilfred Stott. He makes this point. This is the earliest name given to Sunday. All four Gospels emphasize very strongly that the resurrection took place on the first day of the week, even when they could have said the next day, seeming to show that the title was important to them. It immediately distinguished the Christian Sunday from the Jewish Sabbath, the seventh day. And just as in Jewish minds, the seventh day was intimately connected with the account of creation in the first two chapters of Genesis, so the first day was, in the eyes of Christians, connected with the same sequence of events in the creation narrative. So this new creation, we'll get into all that, but where did I put this thing? Okay. So, so other than the first day of the week, the only other day that's mentioned is in Revelation 1:10. And I've kind of already discussed this, how it just sort of appears. We don't really have any other context for it other than outside sources, which we're going to get to in a sec. So in Revelation 1:10, writing about maybe 90 AD, I think is where most put it, says, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. And I put, you know, compare this with 1 Corinthians 1:8, 1 Thessalonians 5:2. So there is a distinction. I've heard people say, or try to make the argument here, that we're talking about an eschatological day. We're talking about the day of the Lord. Well, the day of the Lord is used very explicitly throughout the New Testament as well. And in every instance, he's talking about the end of all things, the coming of Christ, the day of the Lord. In this instance, he's really not talking about any eschatological. He's saying, this is the day on which this happened. You good to connect that. All right, so here's where the Didache comes up that I talked about. This is chapter 14, verse 1. And it says, and writing about the same time, and actually a lot of scholars predate, they make the Didache predate Revelation. It's actually John's Revelation comes after the Didache. It says, on the Lord's own day, gather yourselves together and break bread and give thanks. So, And the construction of the Greek, and I'm not going to try and wow you with too much, I don't know any Greek, I just thought I'd point that out. But what scholars have said is the construction of the Greek here is very similar to 1 Corinthians 11:20, where he's talking about the Lord's Supper. So we're taking a supper, making it the Lord's, giving it a holy name, essentially. In the same way, we have what seems to be taking a day and putting the Lord's in front of it in the same way to make it a distinct day, an important day. Okay. Oops. All right, so basically I think what the argument that I'm trying to make here is that in the Gospels, the historic account, and the epistles, which take place around the same time, we have this idea of the first day of the week. And by the end of the century, we have here what starts to develop as being called the Lord's Day. So you'll see in all these extra biblical accounts this connection between Sunday and the Lord's Day being the same. The first day of the week is the Lord's Day. So, and I think that's an important point, because I actually don't think if you run across people who are like, well, it's a development of later councils and churches, or it's just extra biblical. We can't rely on that. I don't know if that's actually a wise way to treat the New Testament, as though it's disconnected from a historical context. I mean, there were people, and there was a context surrounding the New Testament and its use of language. So this idea that we can't use any of these sources that were literally being written at the same time as one of the New Testament books and just discount them as, well, you know, their use of the Lord's Day is not important to how we interpret Revelation 1:10. Maybe we can discuss that if you disagree, but I don't think that's a good way of dealing with history or the Bible. So, this is Ignatius in his letter to the Magnesians, around the same point. He's writing in Antioch, which is just north of where the Didache is being written at. And he says, if then those who had walked in ancient practices attained unto newness of hope, no longer observing Sabbaths, but fashioning their lives after the Lord's Day, on which our life also arose through him and through his death, which some men deny. Wow. I don't know what happened. Can you pop that back up? Sure. Yeah, right there. Up. Yeah, that's fine. Just, yeah. It's a little down on the bottom right, this little thing. Thanks, Jonathan.
I'm pretty sure I didn't press any. Sorry. I'm not doing that.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, I just deleted the whole thing. That'd be great. All right, do it one more time. I think I know what I did.
Okay.
I mean, you did. Just pop it up. That's fine. I can go from there. Why did they make this button so close to the... All right. So what I do think is interesting here is he is starting to develop sort of a theology of the change of the day, that we celebrate the Lord's Day on which the Lord arose. And again, I hate to do this. We're gonna come back to those arguments. I just... wanted to point it out, I guess, as a point of interest. Okay, the Gospel of Peter is apocryphal. I don't think it doesn't fall into the Gnostic Gospels necessarily. It's just it may have been just some guy's account of what happened. I don't know. His name may have been Peter, but this is dated actually according to Bart Ehrman. See, I used the atheist to date it here so that we can, you know, it's legit. No, I'm just kidding. But in the night in which the Lord's Day dawned, when the soul, and I'm abbreviating this obviously, now at the dawn of the Lord's Day, Mary Magdalene, and actually I put this next one here so that you can kind of see what I'm arguing here, that there is a development on what's being described as the first day of the week to the Lord's Day. So, and the right there, John 21, now the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene, and the Gospel of Peter, now at the dawn of the Lord's Day, Mary Magdalene. So he's telling the same story, just using a different idiom at this point. So, okay. So, with that, Sometimes. Ooh. All right. Let's see if we can get through some of this here. So I'll probably run through this fairly quickly. Just again, stay tuned, I suppose, if I just open more cans of worms and we don't discuss them in depth here. So this is the New Testament evidence of a change of a day. And again, I'm not necessarily making the biblical case yet or the systematic case for it yet. I'm just pointing out how the New Testament deals or how it seems to develop as the narrative goes on. So the day before Christ's resurrection, we find the disciples resting on the Jewish Sabbath. After the resurrection, the Jewish Sabbath is never mentioned again except as a tolerated option for Jewish Christians. So that'd be Romans 14. Or an intolerable imposition by Judaizing heretics. So that's your Galatians and Colossians. And then, or in passages where Paul reasons with the Jews in the synagogue on the Sabbath. So, you'll actually see in, if you go to the Seventh-day Adventist website, they'll use these reasons as actually why it remains the Saturday. Rather than, you know, seeing it as, it was still a day kept by the Jews, the seventh Saturday. And it would make all the sense in the world for Paul to go and reason with the Jews on the day that they're all congregated. So, that's not necessarily an establishing point for your argument. I mean, that's not a good argument necessarily for why it remains the seventh. In fact, it would seem if Paul has the time to go and reason with the Jews on their Sabbath, he's probably not, you know, preaching. Well, maybe. I don't know. I don't want to make that argument, I suppose. But he's not congregating with the church at that point. So, all right. And then, like I've been saying, from that point on, the reference is made to the first day of the week or the Lord's Day. So we've already looked at these passages. Yes. And actually on this point here on the use of the Lord's Day in Revelation, and I really do think you get kind of tossed to the wind whenever you're so, I don't want to use this term in the wrong way, but so biblicist about how you're going to interpret this that you won't use any outside sources. You start to get into pretty murky waters about exactly what's going on here. And you start to import all these arguments into what he means by the Lord's Day. I think John Owen actually makes a really good point here on the use of Revelation 1:10, or John saying the Lord's Day. He says that from those times, so he's talking about the use of the first day of the week, from those times downwards, the first day of the week had a solemn observation in all the churches of Christ, whereby they owned its substitution in the room of the seventh day, applying the duties and services of the Sabbath unto it, and that this was owned from the authority of the Lord is declared by John in Revelation, who calls it the Lord's Day. This is important. Whereby he did not surprise the churches with a new name, but denoted to them the time of his visions by the name of the day, which was well known unto them. And there is no solid reason why it should be so called, but that it owes its preeminence and observation unto his institution and authority. And no man who shall deny these things can give any tolerable account how, when, or from whence this day came to be so observed and so called. So, I know I'm beating the horse at this point, but, he uses it in such a way that it just appears out of seemingly nowhere to us, but wouldn't have to them. That's an important point to me. They would have read that and been like, oh, the Lord's Day. You know. This is why we've looked to the extra biblical accounts here. So to the point that I brought up real quickly here, that it originated with the Jews and not with some outside influence from Gentiles. So a couple quick points here. The only mentions outside of Palestine are the New Testament examples. So the ones we've read, like Corinthians or whatnot. Those are the only examples of the use of first day or Lord's Day outside of Palestine. And all of those are in the presence or by Paul himself. a proud Jew. So, he would have corrected that probably had that. So, earliest post-biblical references of the Lord's Day, the ones I've cited above now, Gospel of Peter, Didache, Ignatius, include more than one from Syria, related to Palestine in geography and language, and the rest from Palestine. So the Didache is from Palestine, and may even predate Revelation 1:10, which I've already said. And then the Ebionites. I completely forgot to hand out my little timeline here. If you're interested, I have them up here. It had a little blurb on who the Ebionites were, mostly condemned as heretics. They denied the divinity of Christ, but they attached, they're pretty much who a lot of people speculate were the Judaizers. They attached the Jewish laws onto Gentile Christians. But so the non-Gnostic part of the Ebionites, an anti-Pauline Judaizing sect which originated from the Jewish Christians of Palestine, observed the Lord's Day as well as the Sabbath. So they observed both. Alright. Okay. And I'm not going to read this whole thing, but this is the Epistle of Barnabas, which is also an apocryphal gospel. And also makes this argument for the change of day, and from the same region, being a Jewish source, so. And same with Justin Martyr. I'm gonna, like I said, I always send these out, so I'll send it out. I actually think that, some of these are really interesting quotes. If you have time, you know, look them over. And Eusebius is quite a bit later. But he's also talking about the change of day and actually provides an interesting theology here. So I thought I would read this one in full real quick as we're kind of closing up here. And he says, so refusing these, the false Sabbath, the word through the new covenant changed and transformed the feast of the Sabbath to the rising of the light and handed to us the image of a true rest, the Lord's day that saves, the first day of light, on which the Savior of the world, after all his works, and having brought back victory over death, crossed the heavenly gates and completed his work of 6 days. On that day, which is the day of light and the first of the true sun, we also ourselves coming together, celebrating holy Sabbaths and spiritual, we who have been redeemed from all nations throughout the world, we are offering spiritual sacrifices. And I like this one for a lot of different reasons, but one of the interesting ones that we're going to see when we get to biblical is, if you have time later, go and look up Hebrews 4:10, where it talks about he who has rested from his works, he who enters his rest has also ceased from his works as God did from his. And you'll see kind of an interesting connection here. If you've ever read that verse and to possibly interpret that as saying the person that's entered his rest as God did from his might actually be Jesus Christ, who has rested from his works as God did from his works. And I think this is a really, because a lot of people attribute that thought to John Owen way later. I think you actually see this idea running through the early church and early Sabbatarians, that after 6 days of work, Christ rested from his works on the day that he arose and ascended. And in the same way, we celebrate that day as a new creation. We'll get into all of that, but... So, I think with the next one, we'll start to talk about, so what about Constantine? Because that's what a lot of people attribute the change to. You can kind of read here how people might think that. He lays down a decree that's fairly Sabbatarian. So everyone stop working, except for people who reside in the country, so they can cultivate their fields. So we'll look at that one next time. I think that pretty much does our time. So if there's any questions or comments, yeah.
To argue that you're somehow more spiritual, or the argument is more cogent because it's only taken from Scripture, seems to be similar to the argument that in the Greek language, basically, Homer was their Daniel Webster, if you will, because all of the reference points of what the language means go back to Homer, and then it ends up taking its meaning a lot of times from Homer. So you study Homer in order to be understand biblical Greek, and in the same way that we, you know, go back to Daniel Webster, because that's kind of the origin, you know, where you have a definition of what American English means. So it's, you have to refer to extra biblical sources to be able to get the flavor, the intent, the fuller meaning. How does the culture use that language? And in a similar fashion, you're using these extra biblical sources to come up with what does this phrase, the first day of the week or the Sabbath, what does that mean in the culture? And I think that's exactly right on.
Yeah. But I think, you know, one of the most common questions after I opened the can of worms last week was the change from Saturday to Sunday. And I think I've hopefully started to develop a little bit that the early church recognized the Lord's Day and the Sunday. And that's not just some extra biblical thing that we can't appeal to. It has a direct connection to the New Testament and his use of the Lord's Day. So I hope that was clear, at least, that maybe it's helpful. Right.
So,
yeah, go ahead, sorry.
So all these quotes from the first 3-4 centuries that you've shown here. How would the Adventists deal with those quotes? And then B, are they saying they had quotes in their own saying that it was still the seventh day?
Yeah, that's probably there's, I don't know that the Adventists actually have a, they deal with a guy on the next time that makes a bunch of arguments for, why it's not observed the same way that we think in maybe Sabbatarian circles, but I don't think he's a Seventh-day Adventist. I don't know, if y'all are able to find any, let me know. I'd be interested to know. I'm sure they could, because I think, like I said, all they'd have to do is find people like the Ebionites or something that are like, we still observe the Jewish Sabbath or something. You could probably make that argument. But.
Well, I mean, I think it's just like you're showing me, so that Eusebius, we're showing some fairly prominent
sure.
church fathers who were showing that, yes, this is what's happening.
Right. So I don't think you would maybe find some of the more, I hate to say, relevant individuals, you know. But you'll probably be able to find, you know. Like I said, a lot of weird things are said by church fathers and stuff sometimes. But I think my point especially was to connect the New Testament to the early church's sayings about it. Anyway, any other questions or comments? Nothing.